Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Tube podcast. Today, we're going to talk with a chronicler. As you know, we organize our podcasts into different categories. We have musician educators, we have producers, presenters, and we also have chroniclers. And I love it when musicians write about the music because they bring this extra dimension that critics, you know, not necessarily can't bring, because there's a difference, big difference between playing and talking about playing. And today we have a player who's also a chronicler. He's written a fascinating book, Jazz, America's Gift. And we're going to talk about the book. And let's dive right in. Well, welcome, Richie Gerber.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here, Ken.
So we were talking a little bit before the call started, and basically the book is divided into two pieces. The first third, you said, tell me again what do you have in the first third of the book, and then what the second third, two-thirds are about.
Well, the first third of the book, Jazz America's Gift, is actually the full name of the book. It'll give you a hint. Jazz America's Gift, From Its Birth to George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and Beyond. So the first third of the book is the roots, the beginning of jazz in America, from pre-revolutionary America through minstrelly, the minstrels and spirituals and blues. And then the second two-thirds of the book focuses in on the life and times of George Gershwin, and a focus on Rhapsody in Blue and his creation of that, and also his life and times of George Gershwin.
Gotcha. And in the notes to the book, and this is another thing we were talking about before we started recording, you mentioned all that there's just a wide variety of inputs into jazz. And, you know, for example, I don't know if this is in your book, but I don't know how many people know, but the very first jazz band to be recorded was all Sicilians from New Orleans.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
That was La Rocca.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that it ended up with him, and that is because a black artist refused to record. And so it ended up that the New Orleans jazz band ended up doing that recording, playing up in New York City off of Columbus Circle.
Actually, you know, I just learned some super music trivia about that a week ago. That was actually recorded in the old Woolworth building where Columbia Records had its headquarters.
Oh, that is pretty funny.
Yeah, and I learned that from a musician who on the side is a professional walking tour guy, and we were walking together past the Woolworth building, and he knew I was a jazz fan. And he said, what does this building have to do with the history of jazz? And I said, I can't even imagine. He said it was where the first jazz recording was done. And apparently that's where Louis Armstrong recorded a bunch of sides.
Oh,
you also mentioned in your notes, and we were talking about this too, so fascinating, Louis Armstrong wore a Jewish star. Now, could you tell us why that would be? How that
Louis
came about?
Louis Armstrong, he had a troubled childhood. And when his father left, his mother became a prostitute. He grew up with his grandmother, and when he was 7 years old, he took a job with a Jewish family, the Konofskis, and down in New Orleans, and they had a little bit of a junk wagon, and then at night they went around to the brothels of Storyville and sold coal to the buckets of coal to the ladies of the evening to keep their cribs nice and toasty. And Louis spent dinners and spent all his time with the Konofskis and this Jewish family with children, and he saw what he wasn't getting at home at his grandmother's, that a family eating dinner together. They invited Louis to have dinner with them on many, many nights. And as a matter of fact, on the junk truck wagon, I should say, one of the Konofskis, Alex, one of the brothers, saw that Louis was particularly interested. Every time they passed the pawn shop, he was always looking at admiring a cornet in the window. And they ended up working out a deal, and Louis ended up with his first cornet from that pawn shop, and that's where he started learning the cornet. But then, on January 1st of 1913, Louis Armstrong ended up shooting a gun into the air celebrating New Year's, and he ended up getting arrested as a juvenile delinquent and brought and sentenced to go to the New Orleans Colored Waifs Home. And that changed his life because he was turning into a delinquent, and there was a band there and a band leader, and Louis, because he knew the trumpet, started learning band, the mechanics of a band, and Louis became the leader of the band, and he learned reading music. He also learned the orchestration and how a band operates. Now, remember, back in those days, musicians couldn't read music. They couldn't even read English, and let alone how to run a band. And Louis learned all of those. And so he started out with foot up because he learned about family, and he learned about the music and reading music and being a band member. And he loved the Konofskys, who taught him so much about family life. As a matter of fact, later on, Joe Glazer ended up becoming, who was actually the owner of the Sunset Cabaret in Chicago. He actually had mob connections too, but he ended up becoming Louis Armstrong's manager, and they became lifelong friends. And Louis Armstrong dedicated actually his book to his autobiography to Joe Glazer as his best friend. And in his honor, he wore a Jewish star in the Konofskys and for Joe Glazer. So he was very close. As a matter of fact, he said that he always liked to nibble on matzah as a snack. He loved that so much. So what I say is Louis Armstrong, he was a fervent Hebrew.
I have heard in documentary, I heard him commenting about his experiences with that family, and you could tell they were really, really important to him. Well, so let's talk about some more about the first third of the book, and then we'll switch to talking about George Gershwin and the role that he played in the development of jazz.
Sure.
So most of us, you know, would say, oh, sure, blues and spirituals. There was this pretty large minstrel show industry pre-movies and pre-radio and pre-television. Did you get into that in the book at all?
Absolutely. I get into that in great detail because it has such a important effect on, you know, on jazz. Now, you have to remember that minstrelly, and, you know, we're talking the minstrel era, was, you know, kind of good, bad thing, but it kept a lot of black musicians and black entertainers fed, kept their families fed. And so, you know, it's bittersweet kind of images that come out of that era.
Well, you know, in addition to the, you know, that it's just historical fact that another major sponsor, if so to speak, of jazz was the underworld, you know, and, you know, the nightclubs and, you know, all that. And so, you know, unfortunately, but, you know, fortunately and unfortunately, jazz had sponsor, but very often in the early days, the sponsors weren't necessarily the most savory people on earth.
Well, that's a fact. And as a matter of fact, Duke Ellington once said that, you know, the problem with calling jazz, he had a problem with that at times, saying that jazz comes out of the brothels, comes out of the underworld, the underside of our culture. And he said that, you know, that was a problem, that it had that kind of connotation. And that's basically, that leads you into the Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and the Paul Whiteman Orchestra in 1924, and it was an experiment in modern music, and people were saying Paul Whiteman wanted to make a lady out of jazz, meaning, you know, here you have this thing, jazz, you know, they said that jazz comes from the many different interpretations of where the word jazz comes from, Jazz Bo Brown, but it also could have been from jasmine, which was one of the perfumes that were popular in the brothels in Storyville. And so it ended up as being jazz. It was J-A-S-S, jazz, and then ended up as jazz. And so it has and of course, wherever you have these kind of activities, you find the criminal element there.
So, I wonder if you heard this theory about jazz. Apparently, the very first time the word appeared in print was in San Francisco, believe it or not, and it was used to describe action in a baseball game. And it turns out that there is a Gaelic word that sounds a whole lot like jazz that means basically heat and light, like you would get from a thunderbolt. But I could send you the report someday, the article, if you like. I should post it to the blog because it's pretty fascinating. So it's a mysterious word. I know there was one guy that said, oh, it's an African word and so on, but that's actually been discredited.
Uh-huh.
So it's still sort of a mystery where, though being an Irishman myself, I kind of lean towards the Gaelic origin. Because I think that is a better word, that is a better origin story, that jazz is about light, it is about, you know, flashes of brilliance and energy. And that's what that Gaelic word actually means. And I think that's a better origin if we're gonna have an origin. But
first I learned something from you, that McCarthy is an Irish name. I thought it was Jewish, but that's another story.
I have my brother did marry a Jewish girl in Chicago, so I have two Jewish nephews, and one of them, Sam, did most of the writing for Jazz on the Tube this summer. If the writing, he just turned 18 today, actually. If the writing seems to have improved this summer, you can thank Samuel McCarthy for that.
Oh boy, I have to be very politically correct on this one. This could go either way for me. I love Jazz on the Tube. All of the input that goes up, you're wonderful.
Well, we really love the music, as do our fans, and yes. We're just trying to put as much of it out there as we can find.
So here's a question to Mr. McCarthy. Here we have jazz, America's only true art form. We created it. It's ours. We own it. You know, comes out of the depths of our society, from the underworld, from slavery, and today, right now, today, you know, the Nielsen, you know, Nielsen ratings and all, they did their report for 2014, most recent one, and jazz has a 1.4% share of America's music. 1.4%. Right, down there with classical music.
Well, you know how I look at that. That we're always talking about the 1%.
Yes, that's how I was to do a blog and say, "Jazz lovers, welcome to the 1%."
Yeah, and I mean, I love. Not only do I love the music and the musicians and the history and the lore and everything, but I love my fellow jazz fans. They're some of the most wonderful people that you'll ever meet consistently. It's a great.
They are aging. We're maturing. Let's put it more politically correct. We're maturing, and we're not replenishing. You know, it used to be in the schools. I used to be a school teacher. In the schools, we had the band, the jazz band, the big band. You know, play at the assemblies and all of this and graduate. And now those bands not as prevalent in the school systems anymore because of budget cuts. And it's amazing because I belong to the Gold Coast Jazz Society down here in Florida. And, you know, I talk to them and they say, you know, things are changing. We're shrinking. And that 1.4% is a kind of scary number for us because, you know, this is our gift. Jazz is America's gift.
And absolutely. Absolutely.
During that and the creative.
But I have faith. I do have faith. I see a lot of young people getting interested. On the college level, there's more academic programs for jazz than ever before. And then there's that young kid, did you see him from out of Indonesia, Joey Francesco, I think is his name?
No.
11 years old, he plays like Bud Powell. It's ridiculous. I mean,
wow.
I'm not even exaggerating. The kid can really play. In fact, the way to appreciate him is turn off the video and just listen to him play. Don't look at him.
Right. That is the way to do it, for sure.
Because you'll think, wow, this is a really interesting piano player. And then when you turn the video on, you see it's an 11-year-old. You know, it's unbelievable. So, yeah, I mean, we have work to do for sure. And we
you guys are doing that work, I got to say. You really are. I mean, what you do is so amazing. I'm a big fan of what you do. And to wake up every day to get that, and you have some pretty good people who do research, I'll tell you that.
Well, we spend a lot of time on looking for stuff. Here's the amazing thing is we thought we'd run out of videos at a certain point, you know, that we'd get to the end of them and that would be it. But they keep multiplying. They keep coming out of, I guess, people's closets, out of warehouses. I don't know where they're all coming from. But we're not even close to scratching the surface of all the good film, video, jazz that's available. It's amazing.
Yes,
that's one of the great things the Internet's done.
Yes, that's true.
Hey, let's talk about George Gershwin. Now, probably everybody knows about Rhapsody in Blue, you know, that amazing orchestral piece with the virtuosic piano parts.
He called it symphonic jazz.
Ah, okay. And when was that written?
1924. It was written in 1924. It took him 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Basically, Gershwin was informed, him, his brother Ira, and Buddy De Silva were at the Ambassador Billiards Room in Midtown Broadway, and him and Buddy, Gershwin and George and Buddy are shooting pool and drinking a few beers and enjoying cigars. We all know Gershwin loved his cigars. Actually, his father owned a cigar store at one time in his career. And they're shooting pool, and Ira, and it's a wee hours, and Ira jumps up and says, "Your name is in the paper, George." And George, that was on January 3rd, George finds out from the paper that Paul Whiteman said that he's putting on this experiment in modern music, going to be performed on February 12th, 1924, which was Valentine's Day, and he said that George Gershwin is working on a symphonic piece for this thing. George didn't know about it, and he was surprised. Gets in touch with Whiteman, says, "What are you doing? What's going on here? How can you do?" He says, "Well, you know, it's there. It's in the paper. Are you in or out?" And Gershwin says, "Okay." And what happened was that Gershwin created the because George says, "I can't do this. I'm working on Sweet Little Devil's Broadway show, and I'm opening up a show. How can I do this to write this thing?" And they said, you know, he said, "Okay, but I'll do it." So Whiteman offered to have his genius, brilliant Ferdy Groffay do the orchestration to it, so this way Gershwin would do the music and that. And since Groffay has been with the Whiteman Orchestra since early on, he knew the players and the musicians, so he said, "He'll do it," 'cause And so they teamed up. Gershwin, every day, Freddie Giffray would go up to his Gershwin's brownstone apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and wait for the day's output from George, and then he would run down to his studio downtown to orchestrate it. And they did this page-by-page system. And to end up with, and they took them 2 weeks to write that piece. Unbelievable.
Oh, man.
And yeah, unbelievable. And in my book, I talk about, you know, the Rhapsody in Blue, that guitar, the clarinet, Ross Gorman, that glissando at the beginning, the first measure that runs all the way up, that, and how that was really the, for me and for others, the impetus for the wild, roaring 20s and the jazz age. So it was a big change that happened with that song.
How did Whiteman, let's work backwards. So we got to the creation of Rhapsody in Blue. How did Whiteman even know George Gershwin?
If I would have slipped you that question. Thank you for asking me that. Okay, let's go backtrack. 1922. This would be George White's Scandals of 1922. Okay, the Paul Whiteman Orchestra is in the pit playing for the Scandals. Now let's remember, in the Scandals, this was the competitor to the Ziegfeld Follies. So we got a lot of, you know, scantily clad, wiggling, jiggling women, scantily clad. And we also have the Three Stooges and W.C. Fields. I'm not kidding. And Whiteman's in there playing in the pit. And George Whiteman and George Gershwin hooks up with his good buddy, Buddy DeSilva, and they say, you know, right now on Broadway, a big hit is Shuffle Along, you know, with, you know, I'm Just Wild About Harry, and it's a big hit. So that's U.B. Blake's wrote that with Sissel. And so they said, let's do something. And they decided to do a, believe it or not, a opera, a jazz opera based in Harlem, set in Harlem, and they called it Blue Monday Blues.
Okay.
And Blue Monday, it was set in Harlem. It was 20 minutes, and it was a jazz opera. And one of the things that made Gershwin and DeSilva crazy was that George White said, hey, we're going to have white people doing it in blackface. And Gershwin, he hated that. That really bothered him. But he was not the big George Gershwin in 1922. He was a Tin Pan Alley hack. So what, he had no power, no influence. So they did it. But here they were in this girly show with slapstick comedians playing an opera set in Harlem with white people in blackface doing this. You
wow.
Can imagine what a failure that was. George White only allowed it that one time because he just, you know, the crowd wasn't, they didn't come there to be culturally uplifted. And so that opera failed, but Whiteman was in the pit with his orchestra, and he loved it. And do you know, and that's, you know, 2 years later, 1924, he pulls George out of the hat to do Rhapsody in Blue. And in 1926 or 5, actually Paul Whiteman drags up Blue Monday, renames it 135th Street to better reflect the where it's actually being said, and they perform it at Carnegie Hall every night for a month. Every night for a month, and just so you know, it was the precursor, you could say, to Gershwin's masterpiece, Porgy and Bess. Another opera, but when Porgy and Bess happened in 1935, the difference was Gershwin had the gravitas. Gershwin said, "No, but no whites in blackface. This is going to be blacks doing this Porgy and Bess," and that's how that happened. And so the answer to the question, how did Paul Whiteman even know George Gershwin? I think that was it.
Wow, what a rambling road of coincidence and
rambling road. So then you have this blackface, doing Blue Monday in blackface, which Gershwin was familiar with blackface. In 1919, he wrote Swanee. Not Swanee River, way down upon it. That was Stephen Foster. And he wrote Swanee, how I love you, which was made famous. But that was Al Jolson hit that Gershwin wrote. But Jolson did it in blackface again, which hurt Gershwin tremendously. He really hurt. And a little known fact, so we know, Gershwin being a Jew, like myself, both Jewish, a little known fact is that we know about the horrors of blackface and, the indignities of that, but there was also a thing called Jewface, where performers, singers and comedians and performers use stereotypical Jewish characteristics and use it for the performance. And of course it'll lead you to the shyster, the Jewish guy always trying to get squeeze a nickel and big nose and those kind of, Jew face. There's actually a great CD on it. It's called Jew Face by Jody Rosen that is really exceptional. So, there's a lot of juxtaposition there.
Well, it's really interesting that you bring that up, and that, of course, things like that would make George Gershwin very sensitive about seeing other people treated that way. And if we go back to New Orleans, that sort of formative period around the turn of the century, there was a flood of Sicilians to New Orleans at that time because there was a tremendous, there was an economic disruption there so horrific we can barely imagine it. People were literally pawning their children to sulfur mines to try to keep the rest of the family alive. That's how bad it was. So a lot of people were taking the citrus boats because in those days, the source of oranges and lemons in the world was Sicily. They didn't have Florida really much, or you certainly didn't have California yet. And so a lot of Sicilians got to New Orleans that way, which is why New Orleans had a huge Sicilian population. At the turn of the century, the French Quarter was 90% Sicilian. And, of course, the first jazz band that had an opportunity to record was Sicilian. And there were a lot of Sicilian musicians playing together with black people. And one of the reasons why is they were extremely downtrodden when they arrived. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but the biggest lynching in American history took place in New Orleans, and the victims were Sicilian. So this idea of Sicilians and Jewish people and black people seeing a common ground amongst each other, today it may not be obvious because, it's just we're in a different place. But back in those days, there was a lot of common ground, and that part of the place where they met was in music. Hey, let's talk about, so now we found out how Paul Whiteman met or decided to spring this on George Gershwin. and how he discovered that George Gershwin even existed. Let's talk about the development of George Gershwin, maybe starting from the beginning. Where did this guy come from? And, you know, where, you know, I don't even know where he was born. Where did he learn music?
Okay.
How did
On September 26th, his birthday is coming up week or so. I actually, on that day, I will, on my website, jazzamericasgift.com, I will be posting a blog specifically in commemoration of George Gershwin's 117th year. If he was alive, he would be, but it's 117 in 1898 he was born. The second oldest, Ira was the oldest, 2 years older. Then there was Arthur, the younger brother, and then the youngest sister, Frances, who they call Frankie, who was actually an entertainer, too, and pretty good in her right. And Gershwin was a streetwise kid. He was a hooky player. He was out on the streets playing, you know, playing and getting in trouble. And born in Brooklyn, in the East New York section of Brooklyn, where I am from, only a block from my father's grocery store. So Gershwin and me, neighbors, separated by maybe a half a century, but we're neighbors in the East New York section of Brooklyn. Then his family moved out of Brooklyn into Manhattan. They moved various times. They were a family of nomads, let's say, because the father, Morris, was an entrepreneur, and he was a businessman, but not a very good one. And so over the years, he had various businesses. He always wanted to walk to his business, be close by, so he moved around. He owned, as I said before, he owned a cigar shop. He owned Russian bathhouses. They're from Russia, his parents, from Russia, escaped the pogroms. And he owned a bakery, restaurants. He also ran a book, you know, gambling. He took book on horse races at Belmont Park. You've heard of the Belmont Stakes. Well,
sure.
At Belmont Park, he was writing book. Didn't do well in that either. So he was kind of a wandering kind of guy. So he ended up going from Brooklyn into Manhattan, from the Lower East Side up until Upper West Side, Morningside Heights, if you know anything, the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And so they were bopping around a lot. And
gotcha. And
George was the streetwise kid, you know, that Ira, his older brother, who ended up being the brilliant lyricist of the team, was the more studious son. But George, he was not made for school. He dropped out of high school. He was in trouble, but he dropped out of high school. And in those days, in George's words, were, you know, music, as far as music was concerned, says that, and pianos, it was that the only guys who played the piano, this is a streetwise kid, the only guys who played the piano were pianos were for girls and for girly types. And the guys who played the piano, you know, they defined themselves. But George was a tough kid. And he was actually studying secretly at one of his friends' houses who had to play a piano. And George would follow the depressed keys, and he was learning the popular songs of the day. Anyway, Rose Gershwin, his mother, ends up keeping up with her sister, you know, family sibling rivalry, keeping up with her sister, buys a piano that's hoisted into the brownstone, put into the parlor, and George, no one knew this, George goes over, spins the, you know, the piano stool with spindle, spins it down to his side, and starts playing. And everybody is like jaws dropped when they started to hear this kid play. And Ira was happy because he didn't want to go near it because the mother actually bought it, Rose bought it for Ira to play, but George didn't let anyone near it because he was so gifted. He was so gifted that the parents started getting him lessons with the neighborhood matron, you know, but then all of a sudden he was a phenom. He was so good that he ended up hooking up with Killaney, who was a master teacher, and he went under his wing, and he started studying the piano, and he dropped out, George dropped out of high school in his sophomore year, and took a job on Tin Pan Alley as the youngest ever song plugger, piano player in Tin Pan Alley ever. And
what's a song plugger? How did that work? What was that job all about?
Interesting. Think about this. A song plugger. Plug, you know, remember radio? Oh, he gave me a good plug, right? A song plugger works. He was working for Remick at the time. Big outfit, big hits, had big hits. And Gershwin was there. Let's say he was exposing artists. He was selling. He was trying to sell Remick songs, tunes, to artists for performance. You know, they made their royalties. They wanted to get that. So he was, Gershwin, in his gifted self, was playing the piano, plugging these songs of Remick's to try to sell. And, you know, a singer would come in and they say, okay, so, and go do the rounds of the various publishing houses to see if there's a song that got it. And they used to go into George's, and George was in big demand, this young kid, your high school dropout, because of the unique piano, way he played the piano in such a syncopated, amazing way. Actually, he exposed these singers and, you know, performers to Remick's catalog, and they would, you know, license the songs for their shows.
So here's my question, and this is something to help all of us visualize how this worked. Today, if you want to, if you've got some songs, and Remick was a publisher, which
yeah.
means they had probably writers on staff. And,
oh, yeah.
Then that would be their property, and then they made their money by getting performers to sing the songs. They'd get their royalties, and maybe they'd sell sheet music, and I'm not sure how it all would work, but basically that was their stock and trade. So, of course, today, if you want to do something like that, well, you could put an MP3 on the Internet, or you could sell a CD with all your songs, but such things didn't exist then. So the way I visualize how this happened was, if you're a musician or a performer, you would go to Tin Pan Alley. It was a location. It was a place. It was an area.
Right.
And you would go from publishing office to publishing office and say, what have you got? And then there'd be someone, in this case, George Gershwin, young George Gershwin, sitting at the piano saying, well, here's what we've got today. You know, it's like, we've got ripe bananas. We've got, you know, we've got nectarines. We've got grapes. Except at this time, in this case, he's saying we've got this song and that song. And so that was actually a pretty important job in the music industry in those days.
Yes, being a song plugger. Now, you said something very important, Ken. You said that they had writers on staff and they had song pluggers. Do know that those are two separate divisions. As a matter of fact, Gershwin ended up leaving Remick because Gershwin went to Remick and said, listen, I want to write songs. I want to be a composer for, and I want you to be my publisher. And, you know, I'm ready. I'm bursting with creativity. And they said, no, we already have enough composers. You were hired as a plugger to expose our inventory to singers and performers. You are here not, we are not interested in you writing music. We want you to just plug our inventory from our our stable of composers. Gershwin ended up leaving after a couple of years at Remick because the dead end, he went to Harms after that. But it was interesting that he wanted that, you know, the need to be a composer. And
sure,
the delineation at these publishing houses was quite clear.
Wow. Can you imagine telling George Gershwin, no, we're not interested in your compositions?
It is amazing. But, an interesting thing about Gershwin, though, because I am a Gershwin fanatic, is people can go online, go buy some CDs of Gershwin playing Gershwin. You will hear how this guy was playing in the 19-teens and 20s. What happened was, to pick up some extra cash from his song plugging days, he started a career, side job, a side gig, as a playing in piano, player piano industry, if you will. Okay? And so he was starting to do that out of New Jersey and all. He was, and then in New York City for Aeolian. And so he was doing the cutting piano rolls, and he did 150 of them or so in his lifetime. And some of them have been recovered, found, and remastered, and you can find it on Gershwin Playing Gershwin, and they've taken it, digitized these things, and, you know, you can hear the brilliant, you can see, and you got to remember, this was back in 1919, 1920, and you can hear, and you can say, boy, that's special. This guy, he filled up the piano with creativity. He, amazing guy. So
wow.
I'll say, if you can, anyone can find Gershwin playing Gershwin, that's amazing. And I'll give you a little thing you probably know. There's not a lot of videos of Gershwin, and this is your game, but on my website I have one video of Gershwin playing his famous I Got Rhythm. And it's a live recording that he did at a radio station. The great Jablinski put it up there. That's a biographer of Gershwin. And it's great. It's on my website, and it's one of those. You might want to put it up on the 26th. But thank me for it. You will see it. It's a short clip. But remember this, and this is important, that George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm is the second most popular song form, next to the blues. The blues, the 12-bar blues and its iterations, is the most used song structure in music. Second to that is I Got Rhythm. And you're going to say, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's documented. Maestro Maurice Perez and even Duke Ellington said that I Got Rhythm is that song form, you know, this AABA song form, chord structure that has been used more and more. Now, you also have to remember that you say, well, not everyone's playing I Got Rhythm. Well, you have to understand, in jazz, there is a technique called the contrafact. And a contrafact is, and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker were experts at this, all the bebop guys were, is you take the chord changes from an existing song and you make them into another song. So the most popular one was I Got Rhythm, those chord changes. And Charlie Parker, I mean, used I Got Rhythm for so many of his songs, and so did Dizzy Gillespie. And the reason they did it, one of the reasons was that If you're going to record something and they recorded I Got Rhythm, it's a copywritten song, royalties, permissions and all. But you can't copyright a chord structure. And so they used the chord structure, and then they started to do all of these substitutions and extensions, and they, you know, this is where you get, you know, these creative songs, ornithology, and, you know, songs like that in the bebop world, because they didn't have to pay royalties to,
right.
And so it helped them. And they never got sued for it, says Dizzy Gillespie in his autobiography, To Be or Not to Bop.
Well, I was just, it's so interesting that you mentioned this today, because I was just listening to Phil Schapp. He's got an amazing radio program at WKCR, which is the Columbia radio station, which, by the way, everybody can stream. No matter where you are on this planet, you can listen to Phil Schapp, and he is Professor Jazz, if ever there was one. And today, he was talking about ornithology in particular, and the fact that it came from How High the Moon. And then another tune that was a foundational was Sweet Georgia Brown. And I did not know that I Got Rhythm was the king of patterns. I mean, I guess for people that aren't musicians, just think of these tunes, these bass tunes as patterns that anybody can write a melody on a different melody on top of, same basic chord pattern or harmonic pattern, but it's just a different melody. And as you pointed out, that frees you of copyright issues. You know, something too, you know, economics rules so much of what we do. People wonder where did the big band go? And one of the things that happened was, I believe there was a pretty onerous tax. And I wish I had the details at my fingertips, but I do know that there was a change in taxation of live music venues during the war, and it made it very unattractive financially for large bands to perform. And so, you know, obviously a small unit's always cheaper than a huge unit, but this tax issue was actually an additional issue on that. So here we have another economic contributor to bebop, trying to... You know,
think of songs like this from the bebop days, from rhythm, what we call rhythm changes. Salt Peanuts, Moose the Mooch. Listen to this, Ken. The Flintstones theme. And I used to do that. We're back when I used to have my place and I used to play. We used to do... when we started doing I Got Rhythm, and then we changed it to the and then we started playing the Flintstones, and then you have Duke Ellington's Cottontail and Chasing the Bird and Dizzy Atmosphere and even Sonny Rollins' Oleo. And so it's a way to bypass, you know, these guys were struggling and trying to make a living, and that this was one of the ways that, one of the tricks that they had at their fingertips. And the truth is, though, you know, the truth of the matter is, number one, you cannot, you know, copyright a chord pattern. You can copyright a series of notes, but not the chord pattern in the background. That's why the 12-bar blues is out there. I Got Rhythm. You can't copyright a chord pattern. And the truth is that they use that as a springboard to, you know, the bebop guys particularly, they use the rhythm changes as a springboard to create absolutely new songs. They're new songs. And just to show you the richness of I Got Rhythm, because basically you go to a gig, if you're gigging, someone will say, okay, rhythm, you know, and everyone in the band knows it's the rhythm changes, you know, and everyone will be on the same page, so to speak, when someone says, okay, rhythm. Now, they might, the leader might say, call out, rhythm, Sears Roebuck. And you say, a normal person say, what? Rhythm, Sears Roebuck? And that had to do with a certain kind of bridge, not to get too detailed on it, that it's code. It's like a doctor speaking that no one understands it, but the other doctors know what they're talking about. If
right.
that lead calls up rhythm, Sears Roebuck, the band knew what to do. Or there was another shortcut that they used. It was rhythm, Montgomery Ward. And,
wow.
And those are shorthand techniques, and it has to do with the bridge and the different changes, and everyone in the band knew Rhythm Sears Roebuckle, Rhythm Montgomery Ward, as what they should be playing. So
wow.
Rhythm, it has such, I Got Rhythm is such a amazing song. Gershwin loved it so much, and his creative spirit was so intense and great that he started to, you know, when everyone says, oh, Rhythm, play I Got Rhythm, that he started, he ended up doing a vacation, I think in 32, 33, and he went down to Florida, Palm Beach, stayed at a buddy's house, and he wrote variations on I Got Rhythm, so he can, you know, keep it interesting. And also, he wrote symphonic orchestral piece for I Got Rhythm with various new improvisations. And by the way, that YouTube video that I talked about, it's on my website that I think on the 26th you're going to be using on Jazz on the Tube. You're going to at least have that one in one of your call-outs. That's Gershwin playing I Got Rhythm in variations too. It's
wow.
It's brilliant. And he's such a sweet talking guy. It's amazing guy. Amazing guy. I feel so connected to him. I know it sounds crazy, but
oh hey. And well, he was practically a neighbor just 50 years earlier. So let's talk about, you mentioned earlier on Porgy and Bess. Now that, you know, when you mentioned when it was written and performed, I was kind of shocked because I wasn't really aware that it was that, it had been around that long and then it came out in that era. That, and of course, you know, the great Miles Davis devoted an entire album with Gil Evans to the music of that, and the music is just stunning.
Oh, yeah.
I Love You, Porgy. I mean, every time I hear that tune, I get teary-eyed. And that is unbelievably powerful music. Can you talk about how that came to be and the impact it had at the time and what changes that it caused in entertainment and society, perhaps?
Oh, my God. Ken, thank you. Porgy and Bess is such an amazing story. Okay, let's backtrack. Gershwin. 1919, right, Swanee. It's in blackface. He's wounded. 1922, writes Blue Monday blues. They perform it in blackface. He's wounded. So that Blue Monday, which turned into 135th Street a couple of years later because it moved Paul Whiteman so much, Paul Whiteman, the king of jazz at the time. So anyway, a few years later, one of Gershwin's biggest dreams, I'm backtracking a lot, but it's important. One of Gershwin's biggest dreams was to do a jazz opera. He had this need to do a jazz opera. You know, this is a guy who lived on the edge as far as taking chances. You know, he had it made. He could rest on his laurels and, you know, not, but that's not George Gershwin. It was never. He always was pushing the envelope. Anyway, what happened to him is this. He always wanted to do the jazz opera. Anyway, what happened to him in 1929, Gershwin signed a deal with the Metropolitan Opera to do an opera, to write an opera. And if you're sitting, I'm going to tell you that the opera, I'm going to give you the headline quote. Okay, Gershwin plans to write a new opera, 1929, October 1929. And here's, I start a whole chapter on this, and it's called Extra, Extra, Read All About It. George Gershwin quits jazz, signs deal with the Metropolitan Opera to write an opera about Jewish zombies.
What?
Yeah, okay, good. I think I got your attention. I'm not one to... So anyway, Gershwin wanted that opera. He just wanted to do that jazz opera. As a matter of fact, Otto Kahn put out the word out on the street he would give anyone who writes a jazz opera $10,000, which was a lot of... Yeah, it's a lot now, but then you can imagine. Anyway, it was called Zadubik. Now, in Yiddish, in Polish, not Polish, Central European Jews knew a dubik is a displaced soul, a person who has died but who has not left yet. And they actually take over someone else's body. Think of what was that movie with The Exorcist, that's it, The Exorcist. And just think of The Exorcist, that this person was, that girl was possessed. Now trade it in for a dubik, and instead of a priest, you got a rabbi. And instead of a girl named, you know, Christine, you have one named...
Rachel.
Yeah, Rachel, I like that. So think of that, and these dubiks were here, you know, like a zombie. They're here to do evil. And so it was written in the early 1900s, and it was a huge hit in the Yiddish theater and on the Lower East Side of, you know, in the East Village, you know, where they used to have the huge Yiddish theater, which was actually as big as Broadway theater. It was huge. And so the play became a big hit. Remember, Gershwin grew up there at times, so everyone knew about it. He got this offer in 29. He signed. He says, I'm going to do jazz opera about Jewish zombies. What happened was that someone else ended up getting the rights, an Italian guy, and the dubik was dropped, and George still, that was 29, and George still had a yearning for the jazz opera. And so what happened was he knew about a play that was written by Haywood, anyway, a jazz play that was popular, and he started working with DeBose Haywood, who wrote it, and his wife turned it into this play, and it was a big hit. And Gershwin ended up working with DeBose Haywood, and they ended up doing this Porgy and Bess. The name of the play was Porgy, and it was in 1925, and it was on Gershwin's mind. And so they hook up. They hook up together to do this. Gershwin drops everything. So this is 1935. 1930, it took him a couple of years to write. Gershwin drops everything, spends a summer with his cousin, Botkin, the painter, an artist, a modern artist, acclaimed, and they go down to Foley Island in the Carolinas to learn about the culture of, you know, the play of Porgy and Bess. Porgy was about the Gula culture.
Oh,
in Carolina.
The
Gula.
Okay. Yeah.
And the Gula culture, the Gula Negro culture, this was a group that kind of kept their roots from the African thing. So there was still a lot of that kind of African things.
Absolutely. I just to let people know how close this was, there was a group from the Sea Islands of Georgia that managed to make a trip over to, I think it was Senegal, and they were, both parties, both the Georgians and the Senegalese, were just amazed at similarities. For instance, there's a kind of even to this day, there's a kind of basket that's woven that was used for winnowing rice. You know, before they had machines, they would throw the rice up in the air and the wind would blow the husks away and the grains would come down the basket. Anyway, that, you can still buy those baskets in, I think, in Charleston at the
market. Oh, that's where the gulag, that's where that community was the strongest, Charleston.
Yeah, exactly. So when, in, this was like the 60s, I believe, when this group of Georgians went over to Senegal and they brought their baskets and they brought, you know, various things. And the Senegalese were amazed because it's like, well, we use the same basket. We use that exact design to do the same thing that you guys were doing in America. And it was just a very, so it's very close, a lot of cultural remnants still alive in those islands, even today.
Yeah. And so Gershwin in 1935 goes down to Foley Island off the coast of South Carolina to study the Gulag community and culture, and because he's writing, you know, a book. And let me tell you that Foley Island, the accommodations were not the Waldorf Astoria. This was very rustic. And, you know, one thing is interesting is that George Gershwin was bursting with music. This is an amazing story. So he's gone to the various churches and all. Remember that the Gula took the African and mushed it in with the Christian and the spirituals and the dialect and the cultures, and it all got into a big mash. And mm-hmm. And, you know, part of America. And one of the things they did at their services was called shouting. And, you know, this was, they would do this for hours on end, and it would become amazing, just, you know, repetitious and hours on end. And they would do the shout, and people would pass out and all. And Gershwin goes into one of the churches. It's a Macedonia church. And he goes in there, and he's just taken aback by the whole thing, and he's amazed. And then George gets up, and he starts to shout. Now, you've got to understand this. This is this Jewish, white Jewish guy from New York. In South Carolina, 1934, hot summer, no air conditioning. Everyone is schwitzing, and for hours they're going on. Gershwin goes on. He starts to, and do you want to know something? He started to shout with them, and eventually he, amazingly, to everyone's delight, he ended up being the best shouter, including their champion shouter, were all taken back by George Gershwin shouting. None of them can believe it. He was their best shouter. All I can say to you is this: Mazel tov, George. And so he studied down in Carolina, and he learned the music, felt it, you know, the hurricane scene, and amazing. And then he went back to New York and went back, and he created the music to Porgy and Bess. The first song comes out of the box, the first song. I want you to take a guess. What was the first song created for Porgy and Bess?
Don't know.
Summertime.
Oh, okay. Wow. Oh, my goodness. Right.
Exactly. Wow. Everyone sings Summertime. So that was his first song of Porgy, a good start, right? And so then he's back and he's there doing it. And just so you know, Porgy and Bess was not received well by the critics.
Really?
It was actually of what happened was, remember, George wrote the music, Ira Gershwin and DeBose Haywood wrote the lyrics. DeBose wrote the play with his wife, but they also shared the lyrics too. And Gershwin, it's amazing that Gershwin wrote this music. He wasn't there like lifting the spirituals and taking and ripping anyone off. He created Porgy and Bess. It took him 2 years. And he did that, but him, Ira, his brother Ira, and DeBose, they all were investors in the show, and they lost the bundle. In George's lifetime, and actually DeBose Haywood's lifetime, Porgy and Bess did not make it as a financial success. Later on, it's a blockbuster. But during their life, it was not as well received as you would think. But I will tell you a few things that separate Porgy. And by the way, so you know, my friend, September 30th is, so let's do math, help me here, 30 to 15, so that's 70, is the 85th anniversary of the first performance of Porgy and Bess.
Wow,
you got to do that. You look it up, and I just gave you 2 days of information for Jazz on the Tube. I am very proud of myself. So here, listen to this. What an amazing guy. Now, remember, let's backtrack. Gershwin's a powerhouse now. He is now in charge. He makes the rules. It was, and they wanted to do black, no blackface. This is going to be done by blacks. This is set in Catfish Row, and it's going to be done by blacks. And it was that he insisted on, and that's what happened. Now, you got to understand that what do we get from a few of the hits? Summertime. I got plenty of nothing. And, of course, it ain't necessarily so. So, and besides, I Loves You, Porgy, and a whole bunch of other songs that, you know, unbelievable. Anyway, back in 1942, Gershwin's gone, and they're going to put on the performance at the National Theater in Washington, D.C., okay? And they're going to do that. And it's all slated, and what happened, it was actually in 36, actually, and what happened in the National Theater, and what happened was we have Jim Crow laws in full bloom then, and so they were slated to have separate but equal. So you have this black opera, you know, Porgy and Bess company, and the audience, black couldn't sit in the same seats with near whites. And Todd Duncan, who, and this shows you the importance, how Gershwin impacted the segregation issue and helped, you know, this Jewish Tin Pan Alley song plugger. Todd Duncan, who was the lead, he was Porgy, he said, we're not going to go on. We're not going to do this performance unless you and you need to get rid of Jim Crow laws for when we're in the National Theater. And for the first time in American history, in the National Theater of Washington, D.C., was a program put on in a non-segregated, non-Jim Crow audience. First time.
And this was the 1930s.
36. And that was Porgy and Bess, Brave, Todd Duncan, the lead, and he forced that, helping the civil rights movement. So, you know, George Gershwin was in it and he didn't even know one other great story about Porgy and Bess, because, you know, fighting oppression, Porgy and Bess, you can say, was an opera that was fighting oppression, and the other oppression, that was in America, but the other oppression, that's what, in 1943, okay, I'm going to take you to World War II. The Danish Royal Opera in Copenhagen, Denmark was actually under the occupation of the Nazis. They wanted to have the Porgy and Bess play, you know, show. And, of course, you can understand that the Nazis were not that into it. And they said they would blow up the theater if it happened, to sell that performance. So it couldn't go on. And so there were underground performances that the Nazis could never get to in time. So it did live on. It was shown in Denmark, in Europe, right under the Nazi thumbs. And Porgy and Bess was able to be shown. And what happens was this, is that the Nazis controlled the airwaves, the broadcasting, but the Danish underground use, and the Nazis would go and do their propaganda, you know, this is what we did today and how, you know, how what great marvelous war things we did today, and we beat this army and took over this city and town. And the Danish underground would break in, the underground resistance would break into their broadcast, Ken, and play "It Ain't Necessarily So."
Whoa.
Wow. Oh, wow. That gets me, because here you got it becoming a, you know, Gershwin's, you know, songs and so, becoming kind of a rallying point for freedom and for against oppression. Amazing. Porgy and Bess, amazing. What an amazing.
Wow. Well, if anybody wonders why we're paying so much attention to George Gershwin, I think they got the answer, or at least they got a, and that's probably the thing. This is just a fragment of the answer, and the rest of it, or a big part of it, is in your book. And
yeah.
I think if anybody wants to dig into this story, you know, as I listen to Richie talk, you know, you wonder about, well, what's the origin of jazz? And I think the origin of jazz is good, creative people of all kinds from all backgrounds getting together and working to do something good. And George Gershwin is one of the shining examples of that. And I'm so glad you shared these Porgy and Bess stories. Had no idea. I mean, I'm my only familiarity with it really was the Miles Davis, Gil Evans thing. I knew it came from George Gershwin, but I had no idea what they went through to create it and what resonance it had historically, both in the United States and in occupied Nazi Germany. So, hey, Richie, tell everybody again the website where they can find out more about your book and more about George Gershwin.
Oh, great. The name of the book is Jazz, America's Gift, From Its Birth to George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and Beyond. You can find it on my website at Jazz, America's Gift, jazzamericasgift.com. One word, jazzamericasgift.com. It's available on Amazon, there's also a Kindle version, but I will say this, that the book is illustrated. We didn't talk about this, but the book is illustrated by the Mexican artist who was really the artist of the Roaring Twenties, the Jazz Age. His name is Miguel Covarrubias. And it's on my site, and the images in my book, it's really amazing. I mean, you know, you hear the amazing stories of jazz. You can also see the chronicler of the jazz age and how he put that. He's the guy who did the sets for Josephine Baker's La Revue Negre. I'm not a good speaker of French. So everyone knows that iconic Josephine Baker. Covarrubias did the set design for that. So to get the even though the Kindle version has all the images. The book is pretty amazing when you see all the words and the music all come together. You know, who can ask for anything more? Oh, that's I got rid of.
And, you know, this you know, with all due respect to Kindle and e-books and all that, they have their purpose, but this is the kind of book you want to have in your hands. And
you will put it on your coffee table. You will put it on your coffee table. You're going to get one for your coffee table, one for the kitchen table, a couple for the bathroom, because it's a lovely book. Really, I'm so proud, Ken. You have no idea. And it was like, right, interesting. It's like when jazz, what is jazz, you know, improvisation. This was just like sitting down, and instead of blowing my saxophone, it was like, create, you know, these stories just flowing and coming and, you know, amazing. I just love it. And I will say this, though, that what you do, Jazz on the Tube, is I've been a fan. I've been getting your emails daily, and you do, as I said in our emails back and forth, you are doing a great service for American music, for America's true art form. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, hey. Thanks for saying so. So, Rishi Gerber, thank you for the time. Thank you for assembling these important stories and putting them all in one place for us and for putting this book together. And we will all be celebrating George Gershwin's birthday, and we will all be celebrating the anniversary of the debut of that beautiful, beautiful creation, which we now realize is even richer than we ever imagined, Porgy and Bess. So I hope to talk to you soon. If I'm ever down on your side of the coast of Florida, I'm up in the Northeast in New York. But if I'm ever down by your, I'd love to come by and say hi and see what your next project is going to be.
That is a deal. You must do that. And we will, I know a few of the players around, and we will, you and I, will go and have a good time.
Great. Well, thanks, Richie. And again, it's Richie Gerber. Jazz's gift.
Jazz
America's Gift.
Right.
.com. JazzAmericasGift.com, and that's where you're going to learn all about this marvelous book on the life and times of George Gershwin and his contribution to the music that we love. This is Ken McCarthy for Jazz on the Tube.